here, and I'm a bit upset. You see, I didn't receive an invitation to the National Book Awards this year. It seems that my name is now on a list, the same list of names that certain credit card companies consult when they decide whether or not they can issue you a new card. To add injury to insult, I understand that this year's ceremonies were moved to a new location on Wall Street. Literature is no longer the voice of the people, but those who can afford to write books and be part of this mad fiesta. Well, that's okay. They can snub me all they want, and I'll be the one laughing when the publishing industry runs itself into the ground. I have only to wait it out before these blackguards come crawling back to my Motel 6, perhaps snuggling their way into my bed. Together, we will flick roaches off the kitchen counter and dine on popcorn while we guzzle down tequila and forget it all the next morning. But until that fateful day, our young rolling correspondent did manage to make his way in and talk with a few people of questionable and not so questionable literary authority.
Okay, so I'm here with Joan Rickersham. Maybe, Joan, you could tell us about your book. I'm sorry for the general questions, but you're our first interview for this momentous occasion, so perhaps you can sell it.
Okay. My book is called The Suicide Index, Putting My Father's Death in Order. And it is a memoir about my father's suicide, which happened in 1991. And it's an attempt to write a memoir that feels true to the chaotic, mysterious nature of suicide. And to write that as a straightforward chronological memoir did not work at all. I also tried writing it as a novel. It didn't work at all. It was just everything I tried was too neat and too tidy. And I just realized this experience, you know, it ain't neat and it ain't tidy. And I think I needed to find a way to tell the story that was true to the story. So the Suicide Index tells the story in fragments, in different voices. Some of them are my first-person voice. Some of it's my father trying to get inside my father's head. Some of it is very speculative. Some of it is almost, you know, imaginative, and really just trying to let all the different feelings in, all the anger, the grief, the bewilderment, the humor, and the sort of just that feeling of what happens in a family when an event happens that blows the family apart.
A question, I mean, if you are writing in a disorderly manner about a disorderly topic, why did disorderliness work more effectively than this order that you attempted to impose upon it? Was it the emotions too sharp, too austere, or what?
Yeah, that's a great question. I actually think that there's a way that part of what I think with suicide is it's full of paradox. And I think, you know, when I first found out that my father had died, my first reaction was, that's impossible, he never would do that. And at the same time, I thought, of course. And that was the first paradox. And I think there's a way that this book is both orderly and disorderly. And I think there's a way that that's true of this experience. It's a very disorderly experience, but the impulse when you're the one left behind, the impulse is to try to make it make sense and at the same time acknowledge that it never quite will.
Well, you named it the Suicide Index, and it does follow some kind of order. So that's the thing that's kind of making me a little slightly confused here.
Yeah. No, it is organized as an index. I mean, the chapters are literally in alphabetical order, and there is a progress that goes, I think, from complete confusion to a kind of peace. But the peace is really a peace with accepting that there are all these contradictions and all these paradoxes and that you will never have the full story, that you'll never understand it completely. And I think that the index is actually almost ironic. I think that there is a way that you can't bring order to it, so let's just put the most ridiculously numb, orderly, formal thing there and at least give the reader a kind of guide through the experience.
I'm curious, though, I mean, at what point did order impinge upon the writing here? Because obviously you're dealing with these very loose and feral emotions, and you have to organize them at some point, but I'm wondering when you actually were concerned about order during the course of writing the book, or did this come largely in the editing? Or
no, it was definitely in the writing, but it was in you know, successive drafts. But I think that the order in the book comes from stories. Each chapter stands on its own, really, as a fragment or a story. And I think that there's a way that, you know, one chapter, for example, is about my father's sort of biography, but as seen through the lens of his business dealings. Another one is about his mother. Another one's about his father. Another one is about my in-laws. I mean, so in other words, there's sort of, there is order in the book, but I think there's a way that, you know, with suicide, I think you're looking for the big answer, the big clue, the big solution to the mystery, and there really isn't anything. So it really is fragmentary, and I needed to let it stay fragmentary, but I didn't want the reader to feel that they, you know, that I didn't want somebody reading the book to feel that they were drowning in this kind of chaotic mess of emotion. And that's why I think the index, in a way, it's almost like having a handrail to guide you through the book.
Well, Joan, thanks very much, and best of luck.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So Annette Gordon-Reed, correct?
Yes.
Okay, I'm here with Annette Gordon-Reed. Maybe, Annette, you can tell us about your book and the like, and we can go from there.
Okay. My book is The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. It is a biography of the Hemings family. They're a group of enslaved people who lived at Monticello from roughly 1774 up until 1826, when Jefferson died bankrupt and the slaves and many of his possessions were auctioned off. Some of them were auctioned off as well. So it's a biography of slaves from the perspective of enslaved people, not slave masters.
Now, were you able to uncover any new evidence? Because the Hemings issue is rather a thorny one.
Yeah.
What specific unique qualities are in your book that have not been other books that have dealt with this subject?
Well, it's much more about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, much more about her life, much more about the lives of their children and his relationship to him. I mean, that things that were not have not been written about before. So it was a big research project. So there's a lot of stuff there. It's a long book.
Yeah. How long is this book? I'm so sorry, I haven't read it.
I don't want to say 798 pages.
Oh, that's nothing. That's nothing.
The text is 640. The rest of it is endnotes.
Yeah, but I am the kind of guy who really loves endnotes. I mean, did you have to cut any endnotes for this at all, or I'm just curious?
No, Norton was very good about letting me have what I wanted. So, no, I have pretty much in there what I need.
Yeah. How many years of research went into this?
Nine.
Nine.
Wow. Well, actually, I've been working on the Hemingses since my first book that came out in 1997, but the actual core work on this book is about 9 years.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. Yeah. And are you looking at another 9-year project in the future?
No. I'm gonna do it. The next book is going to be faster.
Yeah.
The biography of Jefferson might take some time, but I don't think it's going to be 9 years.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I mean, does a book of this that matters have to require 9 years of work? Or?
No, it does if you love to research. My problem is I love to write,
yeah,
but I also love to research. And I kept finding things and finding interesting points, and I really wanted to tell their story in the context of Virginia. And so that requires to cast the net a bit, you know, wider.
So what you did is you had a very, very lengthy draft, perhaps, and did you whittle it down to find your theme? I mean, how did the actual narrative arc come into play in this?
Well, the narrative arc came from the chronology of the Hemingses family. You know, when Elizabeth Hemings is the matriarch, when she's born, I follow her through up until she and her family come to Monticello, and then we just follow, you know, their lives from there. So the narrative, the structure was dictated pretty much by their chronological lives.
Was that the case for the first book?
The first book was more, it was an analytical book about historiography. It wasn't a narrative. It wasn't once upon a time. This is a narrative, and so we follow people's lives. It's much easier.
Yeah.
I mean, much more work in a sense, but certainly in getting the structure of it was much easier.
Well, Annette, best of luck. Thank you so much for taking the time out.
Thank you for asking.
All right. Salvatore, if you had to describe your book in 50 words or less.
50 words.
50 words, or 20, well, or 100 words. We'll give you 100. How about that?
Do you want plot?
Plot, whatever you feel is very absolutely compelling.
Well, it's a novel. It took me 10 years to write. It takes place in Ohio mostly on one day in 1953. And the first time you see it, first time you see this sort of event of this religious festival on this day, August 15th, you see it from one character's point of view, and then the novel goes back 40 years or so and works its way back toward that date from the point of view of several different characters, about six or seven different characters, until it finally gets to the end and you sort of return to the beginning, but now you're in the eyes of a whole lot of different people. So, and hopefully you get a sense of deja vu of some kind, a kind of haunted sense of deja vu the second time around.
And 10 years to dwell on one particular day, I mean, that's a lot of rumination.
Yeah, well, it's not, I mean, the day is in some way the climax, but you see it two or three times, you know. Most of the book is taking place in the 40 or 50 years leading up to that time. But I'm not really dealing so much with, I mean, I think structurally it's about the day. Materially, it's about the people, the characters. I'm really devoted to the characters being first and foremost.
But why 10 years? Was it a lot of planning or a lot of writing, a lot of false starts? Or?
A lot of writing and throwing things away. I mean, my process is basically I write longhand, and then I type out what I have written on a manual typewriter, and then I change with a pencil or pen, and then I retype on the manual typewriter, and then I just repeat that over and over and over and over again.
Does it graduate to a computer? Or?
And then I throw it away.
Oh, okay.
Like, and yeah. It gets it only to a computer when I have to send it to some other place. And frankly, when it gets to the computer, it starts to die for me.
Yeah.
Because there's something about the surface of a laser-printed page. The thing just goes dead. Because you can't change it. And it, I don't know.
It's a sense of finality, perhaps?
It's the sense of too much finality, I think. A manual typewriter is an interesting instrument because it's not... even the spaces between the letters change depending on the way you're typing. So you really feel like you've got a record of the way you think the page is right now. But it's not settled, and it gets a little bit closer all the time to settled.
I'm wondering if you use a typewriter, because a lot of writers who do write on a computer have the distraction of the internet. I mean, even if you write on a laptop.
Frankly, yes. I mean, when I started this habit, it was really before the internet.
Yeah.
That's how long I've been working on this fucking thing. But, I didn't really know. I later on, when I decided to stay with it, there was the things that I was capable of doing on a computer, which I would do at my job, you know, were so much more complicated and involved. And I just couldn't. I knew that I couldn't have access to it in my workspace because I was trying to concentrate.
Yeah. Well, Salvatore, thanks so much for taking the time out.
Thank
best
you
luck.
Very
All right.
much.
Thanks.
Take care.
Sure.
She comes down from Yellow Mountain on the dark flat land she rides.
Okay, so I'm here with Mark Cody, the man behind...
I'm sorry, Mark Doty.
Mark Doty, I'm so sorry. I am here with Mark Doty, mixing up my C's and my D's, with a poet here, of Fire to Fire. Mark, 25 years of poetry. Now,
yes.
How did you compile this? Was there a very careful selection process? Did the selection process take as long as writing the poetry?
Thank goodness I didn't spend 25 years selecting. Honestly, it was sort of a torturous process because, you know, it's like you're giving a party and you can only invite so many people to your party, but you have too many friends, so you have to make choices. You have to leave things out to fit the page, size for the book. So I had to decide what poems I could allow to recede in the background and what to keep in. I tried making lists. I asked my friends. They made lists. There were no help at all. They just picked their favorite poems. I finally just kind of plunged in and did it. And I've already felt that I left out some things I shouldn't have and probably put in things I shouldn't have. But, you know, you just do the best you can at that moment. Finally, you have to trust your intuition in the now.
I wonder what you do, because sometimes some readers are not going to necessarily read the thing from beginning to end.
Exactly.
And people are going to flip through. I mean, did you consider this in the selection process?
I did, because the truth is that a selected poems is something like a reference book. People will turn to find a poem they're interested in, or they'll, as you say, you'll flip around. But poets always have to operate under the illusion, or at least the hope, that there are a few readers out there who will actually sit down and read it cover to cover to see what kind of shape that you've made. And I know that I don't even do that myself unless I really love a book. But you still have to speak to those people, too.
Yeah. Now, my colleague, Jason Bogue, unferreted some information from you that you are now wrestling with Walt Whitman, like many other poets in the past, Jack Spicer and Allen Ginsberg. I mean, this has to be an imposing dilemma, given the fact that so many have, in fact, wrestled with Whitman. How are you wrestling with Whitman, exactly?
Well, I want to think about the common ground that I share with Whitman, a real interest in the relationship of the individual, the single self, to the community. Whitman is always trying to figure out where the margins of himself are, and often he feels like he doesn't have any. That's been an obsession of mine, too. He's a person who was so interested in affirming the body and at the same and the pleasures of sex and of physical life, and at the same time a person who was absolutely obsessed with mortality and the end of physical life. So those are all things that matter to me. And I love the way that he really thought his poems could change the world. He thought he could write a poem which would cause people in America to be so affectionate with each other that we would solve our national problems. And I don't believe I can do that, but I love the idea that a poem could be that ambitious, you know, have that kind of goal in the world. So I'm going to try to think about those things, and we'll see where it takes me.
So you're not going to ridicule him and talk about neon fruit supermarkets?
I don't think so, but I might talk about some grocery boys, you know.
Well, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Okay.
I'm here with Candace Bushnell. We're going to try to be really quick, but I must ask you, you're here for the National Book Awards. I'm curious why you're here and what the last book you may have read might have been.
The last book I read?
Yes.
Oh, goodness. Well, I'm reading White Tiger, and I guess the last book I read was Buddenbrooks, which I probably finished before I went on book tour for my new book, One Fifth Avenue. So I've just gotten back from about a three-month book tour.
Do you gravitate to the Booker Prize winners generally, or do you read them all? Or
I read whatever interests me. So I'm interested in classics and contemporary fiction.
And you're here for the National Book Awards specifically in what capacity? To exude glamour or what?
To celebrate books. Something. You know, this is the business that I'm in, publishing. I've written 5 novels.
Absolutely.
And you know, and this is about publishing, so it's always a treat for writers to come out and see other writers. So thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well,
that's great.
Sure. So I'm here with another National Book Award nominee. Perhaps you can tell me your name and the book and that kind of thing. We can go from there.
Richard Howard, and I'm a poet, and I hope to win.
You hope to win? Do you? What makes you sure that you're going to win, or are you sure?
No, I'm not at all sure. There are 3 of us who are very good, very likely to win, and I would be one of them. That's all.
How much poetry, I mean, how many years of poetry did it take for you to put in this? What?
Well, I won a Pulitzer back in 1970, and so I feel that I've been there for some time.
Is the process of writing poetry, is it more difficult or easier? Or?
No. Neither one.
Neither one. It's the same. How about long does it take you to crank out a poem? How long does it take you to crank out a poem?
A day.
A day? Okay. Well, thanks so much.
Industry, a free enterprise. So let me sit you down and tell you how I won first prize. I took on your free enterprise and your pretty little shops. I walked in with empty bags and walked out with a lot. So I come for my own.